Oregon. More information can be found at KBOO.FM on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of SEMA, Sacred Prayer Ceremony of the Whirling Dervishes, on Sunday, June 23rd from 3:30 to 5 p.m. at the Monte Villa United Methodist Church in Portland. SEMA is a ritual of music, poetry, and synchronized movement that embodies the journey of the soul. The Mevlevi Orchestra will accompany the ceremony with authentic classical Turkish SEMA music. Again, that's SEMA, Sacred Prayer Ceremony of the Whirling Dervishes, on Sunday, June 23rd, from 3:30 to 5 p.m. at the Monte Villa United Methodist Church, 232 Southeast 80th Avenue in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 10 o'clock. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned, values-driven, natural foods cooperative open daily from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., featuring farm-direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and a weekly farmer's market every Wednesday year-round. Located at Southeast Tibbett Street and 21st Avenue in Portland for almost 50 years. Online at peoples.coop.
Need some food in my belly. Need some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away, just because it ain't the right size or perfect, cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Food Show. I'm Tal Caspi.
And I'm Emily Becker.
Hey everybody, we have a fun perk for you today. Listen in, and we're going to give away some tickets later in the show.
That sounds exciting.
That is very exciting.
So today we're talking all about the magic of fermentation. We'll talk to a tempeh maker, learn about fermenting vegetables, and chat with cider makers. Fermentation is always fascinating and usually really delicious.
And stinky.
Sometimes.
In the
usually,
best way.
Yeah. I always think of it as a science project. Tal, what kinds of fermented foods do you like to eat and to make?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many, of course. But my favorite is a Japanese style of fermented tofu called misozuki. I love to turn it into an egg substitute that I use for my scrambles. It has way more depth than simply taking tofu and adding turmeric to it and frying it up. I also, of course, love making sauerkraut, which is simple to do and super fun and a great group activity.
It is really fun to do with a group. I like to make it. I think that I'm like maybe kind of a typical Portlander, like a lot of people. I read Sandor Katz's Wild Fermentation, and that was like my gateway drug to fermentation. I've been making fermented foods and beverages for a long time. I think of it kind of like an art. I think Katz, his book really makes you want to just experiment and try things. And so I'm hoping that our listeners today kind of come away from the show wanting to try things out and experiment in the kitchen. And it's a great adventure.
It really is.
Yeah, I like to make kimchi and pickles and kombucha and lots of other things.
I think I actually drink more kombucha than I do water. That's very typical Portland.
Is that good for you? Probably.
I'm not sure.
And besides fermenting vegetables, I also make cider. I've been volunteering with the Portland Fruit Tree Project for a really long time, and I kept ending up with so many apples, like way more than I wanted to make into applesauce or apple butter. So I started to press the apples and ferment them into cider, and I think alcohol is really the way to go if you have too much fruit. It's a great way to preserve it. But there's tons of different ways to preserve or to ferment things, and I'm really excited to learn from our guests all about fermentation.
Yeah. To start today's journey into fermentation, we have John Kenneth McCammon, owner of Squirrel and Crow Tempeh. John is going to teach us all about the mysteries of tempeh. All right, let's start with what tempeh is and how you make it.
Yes, thank you. My most frequently asked question, what is tempeh? So traditionally, tempeh is a soybean-based ferment where you take split soybeans and inoculate them after cooking them with the rhizopus mold.
Can you say that again?
Rhizopus. There's actually two types of rhizopus mold that are technically considered tempeh. There's the rhizopus oligosporus, and then there's rhizopus oryzae. And both of those are indigenous to like Java, Indonesia, Micronesia, and you can just get them off of a hibiscus leaf. Or so it's sort of a discovered food in a way. The Chinese had brought over tofu making, and that was a staple food. And the byproduct of tofu making is what's called akara, right? That's at least the Japanese word for it, which is the soy pulp after it's all been ground up and extracted. The juice of it is coagulated into tofu, but the byproduct akara is just sitting there, and there's like some things you can do with it, but it's
so
mostly
is that like
a byproduct.
The, like the whole soybean.
It's like the fiber.
The fibery bits, okay.
Yeah, or like the bran.
It's called akara?
Yeah, that's what the Japanese call it. I'm not sure of the word from other places, but the story goes, obviously, this is thousands of years ago. But the story goes that someone discovered some moldy akara, and they were like, hey, I'm still hungry. Let's eat it. And it was delicious. So then they started making it. So there is still traditional like soy press cake tempeh being made, but then they also use the whole soybean, which is really delicious. My company, Squirrel and Crow, specializes in non-soy-based tempeh. So we use other beans, like lentils and chickpeas and black beans and pumpkin seeds and corn and mung beans. And, you know, we like to joke if, you know, sort of like the can I pickle that with the can I tempeh that. So pretty much anything in the bulk section at your grocery store could be tempeh.
I just want to jump in real quick and just say that your tempeh is the best tempeh I've ever had.
Well, that's, you know.
Just bar none.
That's
amazing.
That's a very nice thing to say. And part of that lends it to the fact that we serve fresh tempeh. So the tempeh that's commercially available is typically pasteurized, which means it's been cooked for you, which renders it dead. That's not how it's traditionally served in Indonesia or places where it's eaten daily. It's treated more like bread. You know, it's fresh. You eat it fresh. And when it's fresh, it's delicious.
So it's not cooked at all?
Yeah, no, it's totally alive. Mm. And so it's not like other ferments in the sense that we're not immortalizing the beans, right?
What does that word mean?
Immortalizing, like making it last forever.
Okay.
So like say miso, for example, right, where you're starting to do salt, you know, you can make things last for a long, long time, well over a year. A lot of misos aren't even ready until it's a year. But tempeh is more like 5 days. And it starts getting ripe, which means other organisms are acting on it, and it can get kind of funky, pungent, though that is an ingredient in dishes where it traditionally comes from in Indonesia. They use overripe tempeh, typically paired with like sambals, like spicy, garlicky, really pungent. It's a really pungent thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of goes into the not wasting food thing, but modern day manufacturers realize that if you pasteurize it and vacuum seal it and freeze it, you have a year shelf life, which is great for bottom lines, you know, and shipping it all over the world.
Does freezing it kill everything off, or could you just freeze it?
Freezing
like if I bought tempeh from you and I threw it in the freezer.
Yeah, it's sort of like the second best quality.
Okay.
And then pasteurizing it is also going to kill all those.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
I mean, freezing it, I don't think kills it. It does damage the mycelium, so it's never going to, like, wake back up necessarily. And then when you cook it, you kill it anyway. So it's not really a probiotic in the same sense that, like, sauerkraut is. it's a prebiotic, right? So it's digesting the beans and making them more nutrient, or it's making it more bioavailable for your gut bacteria to just take those broken down nutrients mm-hmm. and take them into your body. So it's doing the work for you outside of your body, but once it gets into your body, it's just like a more broken down bean, which a lot of people obviously like the great legends of how they're good for your heart and the musical Fruit relate to. You know, they're not always the easiest things to break down inside our body. So the more you can do outside the body, the better off you are.
Yeah.
Right. So for all of our friends at home on bicycles, walking around, can you explain to them how tempeh is actually made?
Yeah. Well, so we soak the beans like you should with all beans and grains. You should soak them for at least 8 hours. We typically go about 10 to 12 hours. And then we boil them. Now, that first step, interestingly enough, we don't do it, but in hotter climates, so there's like a point where we add acidity. And in traditional tempeh fermentation, you're actually doing a primary fermentation because it's in the tropics with that first soak. So when you're soaking beans, it's sitting in water, it's aerobic. And so bacteria get in there and they actually start culturing that soak water. And it acidifies. Their byproduct is lactic acid, right? So you're actually creating the acidity through your soak. We could do that if we soaked in our incubator, like our warm room, but we don't. So that's sort of like a null point for this. But so far as traditional tempeh goes, that would be a primary bacterial fermentation that goes on there. Then they would rinse the beans and then cook them. So we do that. We boil the beans till they crush, you know, till they're nice. We don't want them rupturing and exploding their starch all over the place, because that's really hard for the next step, which is where you drain them and you actually kind of have to dry them until they're at least just only mildly damp to the touch, and then cooling them as well until they're about 98 body temperature, because when we introduce the fungus, if it's too hot, it'll kill it on contact. So about 120 degrees is its upper limit. Usually by that point, it still needs to dry a little more. So we bring it down to about body temperature. And then, yeah, so we use our starter culture, which we get from Indonesia. Shout out to Reprima. They're not listening.
this is on the internet. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe I'll tell as well. I'll tell Mr. Bean Tempeh in Indonesia, my supplier. He's this old tempeh guy, originally from Australia, actually. Started Margaret River Tempeh, which exists now, but he sold it and then moved to Indonesia. And he's a consultant for a lot of people. He sells the starter. Reprima is like the premier, biggest starter culture company in the world. But they don't sell anything themselves. They have like people that you kind of have, it's like a secret mafia or something, where like they have people that they let sell their product.
How do you get in touch with the mafia?
Well, I mean, Mr. Bean is a very outgoing Australian guy. He advertises on the internet.
So you don't have to fly down to Indonesia.
Right,
to
meet right.
Up smuggle it out
one
in
day.
Here.
Take the one product. Day. One day. No, I just
making tempeh is an adventure.
Yeah, it's sort of like a mafia maybe there. Not so much in the wider world. Like, no one can just like go there and be like, I want to sell tempeh starter. You have to be like blessed into their family, uh-huh. You know, to be able to sell their product. And it
we're
helps.
Learning a lot today.
Yeah. It helps that he's like an English speaker and that he has some tech savviness and has a website that sells their stuff. Okay. So anyway, he also teaches workshops in Indonesia, which, you know, is usually for beginner tempeh makers, which I think I've kind of exceeded. But I would like to visit him one day.
All right, let's get back to the process.
Yeah. So we're going to introduce this product, the tempeh starter. Once it's cooled, it's a really concentrated thing because it's made from the spores, which are these little tiny seeds that once they're hydrated, when they come in contact with the moist beans, just like hydrate, swell, and just explode millions more seeds, for lack of the scientific word, onto the beans. So stir that up, and then we use perforated bags. So we fill the beans in these bags, seal them up, pat them into their nice flat loaf, and then that goes into our incubator, which is like anywhere between like 85 and 90 degrees Fahrenheit, and that takes 30 hours. And during that time, a whole lot of growth occurs.
So what would people have traditionally used before?
Well, it's in bags. The tropics. It's just the whole world's an incubator there.
No, for the bag part.
Oh, they would use banana leaves. Okay. Banana leaves is the traditional technique. They do these really long cakes. So, you know, banana leaves are long leaves. Mm-hmm. And so they'll lay them in like a trough. They'll spread the soybean out, and then they sort of roll it over and pin it with skewers. And then those just go up into a lot of the incubators there. Places they keep the tempeh are just like rafters in their buildings. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the traditional way.
But you're using like a machine specifically for incubation?
Well, no, I build them. Okay. It's just a room, a warm room.
Okay.
They have these thermostatic controllers that, and actually that's sort of the way I got into tempeh making in some way. Was because I was doing it as a hobby, right? I've been in fermentation for a lot of years, and the fungal ferments have always intrigued me.
Yeah, we'd like to hear a little more because you have such a background in fermentation, so maybe you can like lead us down that path.
Sure. So I've done sauerkraut. I worked for Farmhouse Culture for a couple of years down in Santa Cruz, and I was also working for a now defunct kombucha company called Kombucha Botanica. That at one point was kind of, we were like neck and neck with GT Synergy, but that was just bad business decisions and co-packing issues where we'd get a bunch of yeast in our bottles because we were running it at a cidery and exploding pallets of kombucha. It's a long, long story
messy.
Thankfully, sticky. I was just an employee there and was able to move on relatively unscathed. Though I did liquidate all of their crocks, something like 200 something 10-gallon crocks, which is what the first thing I did when I moved to Portland was I was selling used crocs at like various events. So I sort of...
Is there a croc mafia? Or
no,
are you just like able
I was
to sell
it.
Them?
You know, it's actually a really horrible product to try to like sell. They're like weigh 30 pounds each. They're like gigantic stoneware crocs. You're just like lugging them all over the place. Every time I like moved to a new rental, I had to like bring 130-pound crocs like to the next place and find it. It was a mess. But I still have two, I think maybe three. Left that I use for personal use. But
so what brought you to owning your own tempeh company? Like why did you decide on tempeh out of all these other fermented products that you worked with?
Well, honestly, you know, 7 years ago when I got here, I thought there was already enough sauerkraut and kombucha companies that I was like, I'm not going there. Like there's already like six companies. And since then there've been like 7 to 12 more of each of those pop up. So I guess my own business brain thought that market was well saturated. But soy-free tempeh was sort of like, I found out about it actually from a local company that's not around anymore, and was really inspired to start trying to do it myself. That leads into the incubator thing, right? It's like, you look online, how to make tempeh, and the instructions I give are pretty straightforward. You boil beans, you dry them off, then you incubate them. Sounds easy enough, but 90 degrees is the danger zone, right, in food. So most kitchen appliances don't hang out there, right? Mm-hmm. It's hotter, you know, or it's colder. So one of the ones I was trying were these hot water bottle methods where you get hot water, you put it in a cooler with some towels, you know, and it's cozy, and you got just like a digital thermometer. You just have to babysit it like the entire time, right? So it's like temperatures drop. You got to catch it before that. And I had like some varied success doing that, but really it was like, you know, you got to make sure it's okay before you go to sleep. You know, wake up first thing in the morning, check on it, find out it's 70 degrees inside your cooler. Like, so I found this cheap thermostatic controller online that basically is just a digital interface that will like turn on a light bulb or whatever circuit to maintain the temperature. Mm-hmm. And what I'd use, like converted like a little mini fridge, like a dorm fridge with a light bulb, just a 60-watt light bulb in it. And that just like allowed me to make it flawlessly, basically. So then the nice thing about that thermostatic controller is you can just control bigger and bigger boxes. So then it was a full-size refrigerator, and then it was a closet, and then I blew out the closet and it was like four times bigger, and then it's just basically taking over the whole space. So
are you, I feel like Tal said maybe you're starting some sort of communal kitchen fermentation space.
That's right.
So the, how big is the your incubator there?
The incubator. I mean, in theory, we could just turn it into one giant warm room. But no, the incubator there is about 15 by 20 foot. Right now, the current incubator is 4 by 8. So,
if you put something else, like, I don't know, yogurt or something in there, would there be any kind of contamination between the cultures?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I don't think so. Yogurt does want to be a little hotter. Uh-huh. But I don't think so. No, most of those things are fairly well contained. And yogurt actually cultures inside of its container. So it's actually not an open, you know, container in the same way that like the tempeh is. But the tempeh is also not putting out any like reproductive seeds. It's not sporulating, right? It's just the root structure.
Right.
So it's pretty self-contained as well. The thing we would mostly be concerned about would be like yeast. And so that's a real concern. Like, if you had a bread maker in there, they just have yeast going everywhere. It's everywhere. Yeah.
So we're almost out of time, John.
Well,
although I just want to know more and more about tempeh. Where can people buy your tempeh?
Yeah.
And is there space still in your incubator communal kitchen? Like, if somebody has a fermenting project they
want to work on? Not even finished with it yet. The incubator's not open yet.
Is it called the incubator?
The incubator, okay. And so that's sort of a play on words, obviously. You know, in business, an incubator is a place for people to start up. You know, a nice fertile environment for people to learn and to grow. So that's something we would like to offer people who are just starting out in fermentation. We think that our expertise, you know, can help move people along. So that's probably due to be open at the end of this summer. You can always get in touch with us. We're on the internet, on Instagram at eattempeh. T-E-M-P-E-H is how you spell tempeh. That's our website as well, eattempeh.com. And so far as where we're available, like fresh tempeh-wise, we're going to be at People's Co-op today. That's from 2 to 7 every Wednesday, year-round. Saturdays at the PSU Farmers Market. Another year-round farmer's market, wonderful produce. And then seasonally this year on Sunday at the King Farmer's Market, which is in the Alberta Arts District. Then we're at the local co-ops Frozen. We're up in Seattle at Vegan Haven and Central Co-op. We're at the Olympia Co-op. And then Life Source down in Salem. And then restaurants around town. We got people using it at pop-ups. You know,
nice.
Once people learn about it, they're pretty excited.
Thank you so much, John.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
John's gonna stay here with us while we turn and talk to Sarah. I'm sorry, I forgot to ask how you pronounce your last name.
I say Pissot, but I'm not attached to that.
Sarah Pissot. Sarah grew up gardening and canning food with her family in rural California. And then while working at a farmer's market, she found herself with too much produce. I think we all know that feeling. And started fermenting and preserving it. After moving to Portland, she continued fermenting food at lots of Portland restaurants, including Tusk. And she now has a business called The Fermentista, which I love that name. And she sells fermented foods at farmer's markets. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit more about how you got into fermenting.
Again, it was more just dealing with the abundance of a season that is so frequent in California farmers markets, but also up here in the Pacific Northwest. How do you save it? How do you make sure that it lasts a week, ferment it, and then you can give it back to whoever you got it from, or you can keep it in your fridge and see how long it lasts.
Awesome. So what kind of stuff do you make now?
Sauerkraut is one that I'm going to have continually through the summer now that cabbage is coming back into season, but I really like playing around with all the other vegetables. Radishes right now are great. Turnips, I've done the base and the greens of those. Those are really wonderful things to have fermented. Most vegetables can be fermented. I haven't run into many that didn't work for me. So it's really just very opportunistic about what's coming into season and what the farmers have on their lists.
Nice. What is your favorite fermented food?
My new favorite, and I can tell you about this later when you ask me for that recipe, is fermented leeks. I hadn't done them before, and I ran into some leeks, and I fermented them, and it was a total barbecue game changer. Put that on a hamburger, put it on a veggie burger. You won't be disappointed.
That sounds amazing.
It was great. It was the caramelized onion. It was the pickle all in one.
Wow. So where do you source your produce and the other ingredients you use?
So I'm pretty small right now. I have some different farmers who I work with. I see their product list and either go pick it up from them, or if I'm lucky, they'll deliver it to my house. Thanks, Wild Roots. also, just being at the farmers markets, my neighbors. I got 130 pounds from my neighbor last weekend at the Hollywood Farmers Market of cabbage. So again, shout out Deep Roots. Thanks, Kimberly. I'm just working straight with farmers. A lot of face-to-face. I'll hand out my business card anytime someone comes by and says, oh, I have a farm. So it's been enough for me so far.
That's cool. I feel like I read somewhere that you also work with restaurants to take like their produce.
Yeah, so again, this project is a new one for me, so I haven't really run into that abundance season, but I'm really excited for watermelon rinds. When the restaurants use the watermelon, they're just going to throw that away, but I'm going to ask them to save it for me, and then I'll send them back with some watermelon rind kimchi or some other pickle to pay them back for saving their scraps for me.
Speaking of restaurants, you worked at, you don't currently work at Tusk.
I don't currently work at Tusk, but I do their fermenting, but under a separate license.
Can you tell us a little more about working there and fermenting for them?
Yeah, so I was a server. As we all know, in the food service industry, front of house pays just a little bit better. But I have a culinary background in that, again, I've grown up with food from scratch. I also went to a culinary school in Santa Cruz, Cabrillo.
I went there too.
Oh yeah. I thought that there was a place in the restaurant to do a pickle program and do it right, like through the department of the ODA. So I went to them and I petitioned. I said, "Hey, will you let me do this out of your space?" And they said, "Sure, whatever you want." And so I did my research, I got my license, and then they let me continue with the pickle program. So now I go in just a few hours a week, and do some fermenting for them. It doesn't take a lot of time. You can get a lot of big batches going. They'll utilize their Tusk is really great at utilizing whatever I make. Some of my favorite things are I call them trash sauce. My most recent one was the ends of asparagus. They're too woody to use in food, but buzz that up in a Roboco with some salt and let it sit for a week, and I think they're marinating meats with it. It's a really good way to get flavor into something out of something that would otherwise end up in the trash.
How do you get everybody in the kitchen to actually save the ends of the asparagus and not just throw it away?
You gotta talk to the kitchen manager and cross your fingers that they pass it along. But honestly, there's so much. Even when I'm in there, like I fermented the asparagus for them to use on a pickle plate, and then I save the ends that I worked with. But there's been things before, like beet greens. When they're processing all their beets, they'll save a bus tub of beet greens for me. And again, same Roboco and salt. You get a nice paste out of that, and it's really flavorful. You can add it to a soup. You can. They were doing it on a toast for a little bit for their brunch menu. Just a little bit of organization.
Yeah. So I want that leek recipe.
Okay, yes.
Tell us how you ferment leeks.
So it is so simple. If anyone has done sauerkraut, then you're going to be completely comfortable with this method as well. I luckily have this fun little slicer, a little hand crank slicer, so I can get nice little even slices. But just take the leek long ways and cut it into little thinner rounds as you can. Salt it. My ratio is 2.25%, so 100 grams of leeks. You'd add 2.25 grams of salt.
Can you say that one more time real slow?
Oh, 2.25%. So for example, if you had 100 grams of leeks, or let's say you had 1,000 grams of leeks, you would do 22.5 grams of salt. So okay. You can just scale up. And two is also a fine number. You don't have to get into quarter percents there. Right, so you have your cut leeks, you've got your salt, you salt it. I added some black pepper too. I honestly don't know how much I added. I have it written down, but it's more of an eyeball, use your judgment. Mm-hmm. Sort of massage it until it starts to sweat out the liquid. I might have let it sit for an hour before I stuck it in a crock, give it more time to release its brine. But yeah, then just stuff it in something. You can be a mason jar, it can be a crock, it could be anything where you can put a weight on top to keep the level of the brine up above the leaks. And then I let it go for anywhere from 6 to 8 days, but you could go a little bit longer, it'd be fine. Yeah, it was a total winner.
So tell us a little bit more about like the science behind it. So like, why are you adding salt?
Right.
Like, why do you want to keep the brine above the vegetables?
Perfect. Sauerkraut and fermented vegetables, they're going to naturally do a lacto ferment, so a lactic acid ferment that has nothing to do with milk. What it is lactobacillus is the bacteria that are most prevalent on the outside of the vegetables. And as soon as you cut the vegetable from the plant's defenses aren't able to keep that bacteria from eating the carbohydrates. So what you want to do is you want to give those bacteria a step up over any of the other bad bacteria that you don't want. So to do that, you put salt in the environment, and then the lactic acid bacteria are happier to grow in that, but they also need it to be anaerobic without oxygen. So that's where the brine comes in. You want to keep it submerged under liquid. And if the vegetables that you're salting don't produce enough liquid, it's fine to add salt water. And then the weight will keep the vegetables under the brine in the anaerobic condition. And then with the salt, the lactic acid bacteria are the ones that are going to have the best start. And then as soon as they start doing their thing, they're acidifying the solution. They eat the carbohydrates and they poop out lactic acid. They do what they do. And then over time, as the solution gets more acidic, you're protecting it even more from the bacteria that you don't want growing in your food. So at the end, you've got a really stable, really probiotic, really healthy, really safe, delicious food.
Fascinating. I think I have a question that a lot of our friends out there have about pickling cucumbers. What is the secret to getting it crunchy?
So I like to do shorter ferments, and that'll help with the pickling process, the crunchy part of the pickling process. The longer you go, the more time the bacteria have to break down the like cell structure, and you'll get softer pickles. There are other things you can do. You can add higher salt. That'll inhibit like pectinases, the things that break down the cell structure. So higher salt helps. Adding tannin, and people traditionally do that with maybe a grape leaf, or I've even heard people just saying they dunk a tea bag in there. So that again helps keep vegetables crunchy. But for me, the way that I like to do it is just do a short ferment.
How short?
For pickles, a half sour, like 3 to 5 days, depending. My sauerkraut goes for 6 to 7 days.
Are you using a temperature controlled environment, or just like whatever?
There's a thermostat in the room that it's in, but that's about it. I think it was set to like 75 last time I was in there, but no, I'm not doing anything special. You could do this at home without worrying too much.
Do you plan on moving into John's space? I wonder.
Well, if he can beat my current rent.
All right, this is something you can negotiate off air. What is your favorite fermented food?
Is wine a food?
Yep.
Okay. I'm gonna go with wine.
Good answer.
So we've just got a couple more minutes. Can you tell us where people can find your fermentista products?
Again, I'm pretty small. This is my first summer selling straight to the public, and I am currently at the Hollywood Farmers Market. That's Sundays 8 to 1.
Saturday.
Thank you, John. Saturdays, 8 to 1. Sunday is Montevilla. That's 10 to 2. And then People's Co-op every other week. So I won't be able to see you there with John this week, but next week you can find us both there.
And do you sell your product to other restaurants outside of Tusk?
No, I have talked to a few about wholesale orders, but I haven't. I'm still focusing on getting the farmers market side of things.
But you'd like to pick up more restaurants?
Yeah, that'd be wonderful.
Then we should talk off air as well.
One more question. Are you at the farmers market? So if I have a question about fermenting, yes. Can I just come and hang out?
And I love talking fermenting with people. I'm happy to be your fermenter if you don't have the time or the energy to do it, but I also really love empowering people to do it themselves. And I love troubleshooting questions that I've run into the past and get people going on their own at home, because you don't need me to do it. You should all be
maybe today
yourself.
This could start a fermentation podcast. It could happen in the future.
Awesome. Well, thank you both so much for being with us today. And I think we have some tickets to give away.
Oh, it's time to give away some tickets. This is really fun. Something we've never.
Should I get my phone? Never. Ready?
Yeah, you can get your phone out. Absolutely. We're giving away tickets to Feed the Masses, third annual luau. Tickets include dinner for two and cooking demos. The lovely event takes place at Cape Lookout State Park on Oregon Coast. So if you don't want to drive out to the Oregon Coast, please don't call in. So let's think about that.
But who doesn't want to drive?
No, I agree.
For a luau?
I mean, someone that only has a bicycle maybe, or a bum knee.
You can bike there.
It's true. Or walk. So the first caller who calls in and tells us what their favorite fermented food will win a pair of tickets. Here's the phone number, 503-231-8032. Operators are standing by.
So call in and tell us what your favorite fermented food is.
Yum, yum.
You're listening to The Food Show, and today we're talking about fermentation. We talked about tempeh and sauerkraut, and now we're going to learn about one of my favorite ferments, cider. But first, we are giving away some tickets, and we read out the wrong phone number earlier. So the actual phone number is 5... All right. All right. Actually, I just heard from the air room that we have given the tickets away. So...
Congratulations to whoever won those tickets.
So now we're going to talk about cider. We're joined here with, we've got Emily Ritchie and Anne Hubach. They're both from the Northwest Association of Cider Makers. Emily is the executive director and Anne is the vice president. Anne is also a winemaker and launched Alter Ego Cider in 2014. Thanks for joining us, Emily and Anne.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you. Yeah. So, Anne, tell us about your cider company, Alter Ego, and what inspired you to start making cider.
Absolutely. So, Alter Ego Cider started, as you said, 5 years ago this weekend. Actually, we launched the brand to the public 5 years ago this
Congratulations.
Weekend. Congratulations. Thank you. In fact, we do have a grand opening and five-year anniversary party on Sunday at the Tap House if anyone wants to come and join us.
Where's the Tap House?
The Tap House is located at our facility in Southeast Portland on 2025 Southeast 7th Avenue.
Nice.
Yeah. So I've been a winemaker for almost 2 decades, and five-ish years ago, some friends and I were having a dinner party. He was a winemaker and cider maker at a very large and very old winery and cidery in Oregon, and he had brought some ciders to the dinner party, and we were tasting them and talking about them. I was really blown away with the quality of them, and we decided to talk a little bit more about fermentation and production of cider and really how similar it is to white wine production, which I have a specialty in with my winery, Helioterra Wines. And so we sort of, the synergies were almost too good to be true. And so we decided, hey, we can make apple cider fermented almost in the same fashion as white wine. And we, as people who are very attuned to fermenting fruits, can ferment apples just as well as we can grapes. And so decided to combine efforts and use the efficiencies of some of the equipment that I already owned, tanks and chillers and whatnot, and apply it to apples instead of grapes. And Alter Ego was born because it's our winemaker's alter ego to produce cider.
That's awesome.
Thanks. Yeah.
And where do you source your apples?
So we source our apples from a variety of places in the Pacific Northwest. So we predominantly go through a clearinghouse that is the cold storage facility for apples all over the Northwest. So farmers, when they have an excess of apples, will bring it to one or two locations out in the gorge, and apples can store in a cold environment very well. So we can use them year-round, which is something that we can't do with grapes. We also are starting to work more with some smaller farms that are doing some heirloom varieties, like Kiyokawa Farm. So we're doing a little bit of both. We're getting some culinary apples from a variety of larger orchardists out in the gorge in the Yakima Valley, and then as well working with some smaller farmers to make some more heirloom varieties of cider specific to variety.
What's the difference in those kinds of apples? Like, why would you want that heirloom variety for your cider as opposed to like a Gala?
Right. Well, so the main predominant difference is that culinary apples don't have tannin. They're meant to be, you know, eaten and enjoyed, crisp, refreshing, you know, your table apple. Whereas cider apples, bittersweets, better sharps, they actually have a tannin component to them. So they have an intensity, a structure to the apple. They don't tend to be ones that you actually want to eat. The variety that most people are familiar with probably would be a crab apple, but there's hundreds of varieties of heirloom and cider apples that you really don't want to eat. They're grown specifically to make cider, and they have more interesting flavor profiles and tannin structure that comes along with the apple itself that you can make really intriguing ciders with the heirloom, you know, cider apple varieties.
Awesome. So tell us a little bit about your ciders. What styles of cider are you making?
Predominantly, we're known for modern, straightforward, fresh, fruit-driven, and aromatic textural ciders, you know, like we do with our white wines. We make our cider very cold fermented, which helps preserve esters, which are the aromatic compounds within the wine, or cider and the wine. The cold fermentation really helps to have a more textural cider. So when the yeast cells are in the cider itself, it gives a more creamy texture to the cider. We also like really juicy acidity. So we've got ciders that do have a little bit of sweetness to them, but they're balanced out with great acidity. So they're great for food pairing, and they have a very crisp, modern flavor profile. We sometimes blend in other fruits. So we do some straightforward apple cider, but then we also do things like a blueberry pomegranate or a black currant and a variety of other apple or flavors that we blend with the apple cider.
Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. So we've been talking about fermentation on the show. So can you just kind of tell us what it's like to ferment apples? Like, can you just like walk us through the basics of the process?
So from the fermentation standpoint, obviously, first you take the apples, you crush them, they press them, you press them. There's a sweating process that goes along with that as well. Once the juice is in-house, for us, what we do is keep the juice cold and pretty much maintain a relatively cold temperature throughout the entire fermentation. Apples tend to not have, or at least the culinary apples don't tend to have a lot of nutrients, well, at least when they're grown out here in the Northwest. A lot of the soils out in the Yakima region don't have a whole lot of nutrients because they're windblown lush, so that soil type inherently doesn't have a whole lot of nutrients to it. So sometimes, kind of like we as humans take a daily vitamin, sometimes we feed the fermentation a little daily vitamin, some extra nutrients to help the yeast have a really healthy and happy life. Mm-hmm. Again, we ferment that pretty cold and have the fermentation process last about 2 weeks. We start the ferments at about 15% sugar, which is roughly half, not exactly half, but roughly half what grapes do, which also means, in turn, the alcohol percentage of cider is roughly half that of wine if you're fermenting out all of your sugars. Mm-hmm. We monitor the fermentation and let the sugars, the alcohol conversion of the yeast, eating the sugars and converting that to alcohol with a byproduct of heat. So we do keep chilling on our tanks to make sure that the fermentation is slow and cold. And then at the end, settle it out, clarify it, and it goes through a filtration process just after blending with either. Sometimes we add fresh apple juice back, or sometimes we add fruits in, and sometimes the fruits can be during the fermentation or at the very end as we're blending flavors. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool. And are you pasteurizing the end product? Or?
We are pasteurizing the cans. We go into cans, and we're also in draft. We have about three times as many products on draft as we do in can. We're fairly small, mm-hmm. Even though we've been around for 5 years, which is a decent amount of time for the Northwest cider industry. Because we all have our day jobs of doing winemaking and our cider brand, we've been trying to grow slow and steady. So right now we have two packaged ciders out on the market that are in six packs of 12-ounce cans, and those are pasteurized. The kegs, there's no way that you can pasteurize a keg. So we do not pasteurize our kegged ciders.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite cider that you make?
You know,
favorite one to drink or favorite one to make, either way.
Yeah, I mean, our the one that I'm really excited about that our cider maker this year was trying to emulate Pinot Noir. And so we took our base cider and then took fresh cranberries from the winter season and floated the cranberries on top of the cider, three different iterations of soaking, floating the cranberries on the cider. Mm-hmm. So you got both the lovely color of that light pink rosé, you know, cranberry hue, as well as the light astringency and tart tang that you get from a cranberry and the flavor.
Floating them before the fermentation, during, after?
So the fermentation, we fermented the apple cider out on its own, totally dry, mm-hmm. and then took the cranberries and floated them, soaked them in the cider, not once, but three different times. Mm-hmm. So that was a process that took about 6 weeks. So the cranberries would have about 2 weeks per float, and then peeled them off. And then...
Did you taste the cranberries after they were in the cider?
I didn't actually. I should have.
I'd be curious.
At that point, they just became compost. Yeah. And then to add even another dimension, we then did a tasting trial with a variety of black teas from Chi Chai Tei down in Selwood and found one specific black tea that we really liked and then blended a tea into it as well.
Oh, that sounds really good.
Yeah, so it's totally dry, but it has those notes of cranberry and tea and, you know, a lot of the similar components that we would try and aim for in our flavor profile of Pinot Noir.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Have you ever put any grapes in your cider?
You know, not yet. We have a few ideas, and one of the projects that our cider maker was dabbling with as well was taking Pinot Noir skins mm-hmm. after harvest and then doing the same thing, soaking those in the cider after it was dry. And it turned out really, really delicious. So we have plans to make that this year. We are also I'm in the process right now of removing some of my bigger red wines like Syrah out of barrel. And we are likely about to put some cider into some of the Syrah barrels to pick up some of the color and the flavor from what was the Syrah. Mm-hmm. And then we're in discussion about what grapes we want to possibly co-ferment this year.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
It's so cool to bring both of those together, the cider and the wines, and to get to do both of it at the same time.
It is. It seems also a trend that there's not a lot, but a few people are starting to do that more and more. And obviously being a shared facility of a winery and a cidery, we are uniquely positioned to do such a thing.
Cool. So Oregon and the whole Northwest, right? We have such a great tradition of growing wine and apples. Emily, you're the part of this association that promotes cider. Can you tell us about like what impact the cider industry is having on Northwest agriculture?
Yeah, well, a big piece of that is our association is in a large region. So my role is to support cider makers in Oregon, but also Washington, Idaho, Montana, and British Columbia. And especially from sort of Yakima all the way up into Kelowna, that's one of North America's biggest apple baskets of North America or of the world, really. So we're supporting having a secondary use for apples that wouldn't go into the fresh market. You know, apples that we see at the store have to be beautiful and shiny and waxed and glorious. And, you know, there's companies out there that are trying to really promote using secondary fruit or vegetables that wouldn't be going into the regular market. And that's totally something where the cider market can fill in. So not only are we supporting farmers that want to use the rest of the crop that's already in the ground, but we also have in the past received grants like from the Oregon Department of Agriculture to help teach farmers here specifically in Oregon about ways they can diversify their small family farms. Here in Oregon, we have so many glorious crops and a lot of small farms, and it's really important for those farmers to diversify. So if they can throw in a couple extra or maybe 5 to 10 acres of cider apples, and those apples that Anne was talking about, those bittersweet, bitter sharps, we call them spitters colloquially because you bite into it and you just want to spit it out because the tannins are there. That's great for the farmers, and then that's also great for producing really beautiful ciders here in Oregon.
Awesome. So tell us about the Cider Association. What kinds of things do you do to promote the cider industry?
Yeah, funny you should ask, because we do marketing and education around cider to grow the industry here in the Northwest. And part of that, we have Oregon Cider Week kicking off tomorrow, which is conveniently you're talking about fermentation today. But yeah, it's June 20th to the 30th. Can you believe we're towards the end of June already?
Nope.
which is a great time. You know, the weather's wonderful. We can be out and about at cider festivals. We're expecting about 70 different events happening in the next 11 days.
It's big.
It's going to be really big, really fun. All things celebrating local cider.
Cool. So I think I've been kind of thinking about the cider industry, and it seems like there's just like always, you know, more and more cideries coming on board, more innovations, things that are happening all the time. Like, what kind of trends for both of you? Like, what are you seeing right now? What's interesting? Like, what should our listeners be drinking, looking for, that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, first of all, we're seeing more and more cideries. Our association started in 2010, so 9 years ago, and we had 7 cider makers at the time. There's probably 150 to 200 cider makers in the Northwest now. Wow. It's just been this incredible explosion. So I think the general consumer who's not necessarily paying attention to every new company like I am, it's just a wealth of new fun and adventure to try new cideries all over the region. And we just launched a brand new interactive map of cider makers in our region. If you go to our website, nwcider.com/map, it's really fun. You can create your own route and go through, explore, go to the actual farms or the urban tasting rooms and meet the maker. The fun thing about cider is they're mostly, the companies are pretty small, like Anne's is Alter Ego. And you really get to walk up and talk to the actual maker and talk fermentation or get groovy. You know, you can really taste what you like. There's so many cider styles that are coming out now. There's fruited ciders. There's super uber dry ciders. Barrel aging is really fun, as Anne was talking about, putting cider in a Syrah barrel. There's a lot of crossover now between beverages. So what I love as I'm introducing friends to cider is there's new styles coming out of the Northwest. There's a lot of innovation. And so if you've tried a cider once, I recommend going and tasting a flight somewhere at a bar and really seeing what style meshes with your flavor profiles that you like.
Yeah, I mean, just to piggyback on that, like Emily said, there's not only a lot of new cideries, but there's a lot of new ciders. And now is a really exciting time to be a consumer of craft beverage because everyone is, in a way, kind of out-geeking each other, you know? Like, there's this, I wouldn't say it's a competition or a race, but people are definitely trying to do new things and come up with new and exciting beverages and ciders to try. And that's one of the reasons why I love doing cider coinciding with doing wine. With wine, there's a ton of tradition and there's a lot of parameters that are expectations of how you produce and what you make, which is awesome, and there's great reason for that. There's hundreds and hundreds of years of proof in the pudding of you know, what the essence of Pinot Noir is, for example. That said, kind of there's no, I wouldn't say there's no rules, but there's so much more leeway with creativity of what the consumer is looking for or what's expected out of cider. And so, you know, to be bound by creativity is no bounds at all. You get to have a ton of fun and get to make a lot of new flavors. So I'd say the consumer really wins on that part because you just have to keep looking out for new cideries. And like Emily said, like, case in point with Alter Ego, you can only buy two of our ciders in the store, but you come to our tap house, so you can try at least seven and growing. So, you know, there's endless opportunities to try new ciders. And then, you know, if you do find something at a cidery or at a tap house or a bar that's a very unique cider, grab a growler. You know, that might not ever be around again.
Totally. So we've just got, like, 1 minute left. Can you guys tell us, like, one event we should go to during Cider Week?
Yeah.
Maybe two.
Okay. Well, I would definitely say the Cider Summit is the big kickoff event. It starts Friday and Saturday. It's in the Pearl District. So look up Cider Summit or go to our website, OregonCiderWeek.com. We list all of the 70 events going on. But an event like a festival like that, you can try, I think there's 50 cider makers coming. So you can really get little tastes and taste what is to your own palate. The other one I would recommend is Loyal Legion is doing a tap takeover here in Portland and Southeast of all of the Gold Cup medal winners from our cider competition starting this Sunday. So again, you can just order a flight and see what you like. And it's a really strict competition. So all of those medal winners have really well deserved what they won. Also, if people want to get more geeky with us, the Upper Lip above Bailey's Tap Room downtown Portland is doing a cider talk on Sunday. So just peruse the website, OregonCiderWeek.com, and find something that's fun that you're going to enjoy.
Thanks so much, Anne and Emily, for being here today.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you so much.
Very fun, guys.
All right, friends. That's it for another episode of The Food Show. If you have any comments about the show or ideas for The Food Show, or you want to tell us about some great events coming up, please do email us at foodshow@kboo.fm. If you missed any of the show and want to find links and resources, you can find the episode at kboo.fm or on iTunes or Google Play. And stay with us at KBOO this afternoon as we're starting up next with Jazz Lives.
Our next episode will be on July 17th at 11 a.m. Until then, I'm Emily Becker.
And I'm Todd Caspi. Thanks for listening.
Need some food in my belly. Need some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away just because cause it ain't the right size or perfect, cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food. Working those lands for corporations don't do hungry people no good, cause people need food in their belly. Everybody's in the same holy boat. People got to have food in their belly. Need some drink for the dry in their throat. A need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right to cut the trees down just to grow a bunch of cheap hamburger meat? You know those trees, they hold the topsoil, and those burgers aren't fit to eat. And you know it ain't right to punish the farmers for growing food clean and poison free. There ought to be a government who protect them, put tax dollars where they need to be. Cause people need food in their belly. They need some drink for the dry in their throat. They need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same. Got to have food in their belly. Need some drink for the dry in their throat. The need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's